You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of September 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
The bond between our two countries is deep and sincere, and both our nations benefit from a close and honest relationship.
We will build a great wall along the southern border, and Mexico will pay for the wall.
Donald Trump tells an audience in Mexico City one thing and his own supporters in Arizona something totally different. What should we make of it? Also ahead.
When you're accused of doing something that is so foreign to your values, it brings out an outrage in you. Apple has always been about doing the right thing.
The boss of the tech giant Apple responds with indignation at his country's hefty, or some would say perfectly reasonable, tax bill. Is he right to be annoyed? And we'll also ask about the return of direct British Airways flights to Iran, whether it will mean relations between Tehran and London improve even further. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. And I realise I referred there to Apple as a country, not a company. Something of a Freudian slip, perhaps. Now, my guests today are Tom Rivers, London correspondent for ABC Radio News, and Jane Kinnamont, who's deputy head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Tom and Jane, welcome to you both. Donald Trump travelled to Mexico yesterday to meet the country's president, Enrique Peña Nieto. And this is what he had to say to an audience in Mexico City.
The bond between our two countries is deep and sincere, and both our nations benefit from a close and honest relationship between our two governments. A strong, prosperous, and vibrant Mexico is in the best interests of the United States and will keep and help keep for a long, long period of time, America together. Both of our countries will work together for mutual good, and most importantly, for the mutual good of our people.
And let's compare that to a speech he made just a few hours later as he addressed his own supporters back over the border in Phoenix, Arizona.
We will build a great wall along the southern border. And Mexico will pay for the wall. We will begin working on an impenetrable, physical, tall, powerful, beautiful southern border wall.
So let's compare and contrast. Tom, two very, very different speeches, almost sounding like they're from two very, very different people.
Very much so, Steve. And I was catching, you know, what he was saying in Mexico as I left the bureau yesterday, got home, thinking that, well, he's softened up his line now. He wants to get some moderates into his conservative base. And as you say, and with your sound bites, it shows a very different story in Arizona and Phoenix. And he wants the wall. He wants sensors in the air. He wants them under the wall. And he says, I want a deportation force in place. I want to get thousands of people out of here the day he says he becomes elected, of the 11 million thought to be in the country illegally right now. So very, very different. In essence, he's gone on the strange journey where he's back where he began a few months ago when he said, look, I want to build this wall. And everybody was laughing. And he's still back there now. And he says, I want to have this wall. This wall is going to happen.
Jane Kinnamont, ever since it became clear that Donald Trump would become the Republican nominee, people in the Republican Party, pundits, Republican supporters have been using the word pivot. I've been saying, don't worry, Donald Trump is going to pivot as soon as he becomes the nominee. He'll become more presidential. He will soften his language. He will become less extreme. And they've kept saying that with ever more desperate tones in their voice. And yet, in the last few days, some of them could say, well, look, it seems like he's slightly softening his language on immigration. He even seemed to be doing it himself. And then he made clear yesterday that there is no softening. There is going to be no pivot. The Donald Trump that ran in the primary is the Donald Trump that's running in the general.
Most political analysts thought Donald Trump would never get this far. So we can't assume that they're right about a pivot or a softening either. You have seen some changes to the way that he markets himself. He's brought in new press people. And here, I think, with this visit to Mexico, he's quite cleverly speaking with two very different voices. But he's not actually seriously backing down on anything. And in a way, he has scored a certain PR coup by getting to have this high-profile meeting with the Mexican president without backing down on anything.
Well, again, let's talk about Enrique Peña Nieto, who is, depending on which poll in Mexico you look at, is either really unpopular or desperately unpopular. I think it's somewhere between 20 and 23% yeah. approval, Tom. And he has been hugely criticised, both before this press conference took place, but certainly after, for not talking about the war, for not demanding an apology for calling Mexicans rapists, for essentially treating Donald Trump as if he's a visiting dignitary.
In essence, standing there and letting Donald Trump say whatever he wants to without interjecting any of his points. And yes, as you say, his popularity is way, way down there. We had an ABC Washington Post poll come out a couple of days ago as well. Hillary's bounced up. She is equally as unfavorable as Donald Trump right now. We've never, ever had an election cycle looking at, I don't want A and I don't want B. And the people I talk to are in the States are saying, you know, I don't know who I'm going to vote for. And if you throw in the mix now of four potential candidates, you throw in Johnson and Stein as well. When you look at those four, currently it's tightening. The race is tightening. It's probably about 41-39 Hillary. If you just look at the two, it's probably about a 6-point difference. Think back just a few weeks, it was a 13-point difference. So things are tightening up. And I tell you, better fasten your seatbelts, because this is going to be a strange old final 2 months that we've never, ever seen before.
Jen, I just want to look at Mexico, though, for a moment, and Enrique Peña Nieto. His decision to invite Trump and then to not publicly face off with him.
He's in a very difficult position because this could be the future president of a much, much larger country on which Mexico depends. And who knows what was agreed or what was briefed before the meeting. But Trump has presumably bets that he can continue to say what he likes and that no leader of Mexico can really push back.
So then why did he do this? He didn't need to invite Donald Trump in the first place.
It seems like something that has not been strategically thought through. Maybe he hoped that somehow he could change Trump's mind or come up with some kind of change in policy that would seem to be a victory, but probably not very well thought through.
Mm. Tom, when you look at the speech from Donald Trump last night in Arizona, mm-hmm. This is not a speech that is likely to help outreach with Latino voters.
No.
Outreach with moderate Republicans. Is he essentially saying, well, look, this is who I am. I've got the support of Ann Coulter again. She was very happy. I'm going for the hardcore Trump voters and sod the middle ground.
Which he already has. So he's doubling down. And that's why this is so curious and unpredictable. Interesting as well, talking to some journalist colleagues who were just here a couple of weeks ago and bringing this very point up. We were sitting discussing this. And the fact that, you know, for years and years and years, a lot of workers out there have not had any kind of a substantial pay raise. The wealth gap is widening, as we all know about, going back decades. This is what has been told to me, and it's not scientifically proven, but that there's a lot of Americans out there that are not saying a whole lot, that don't show up in the polls, that may surprise all of us and actually vote for Trump just for change for change's sake in November. And that might be behind maybe his idea of doubling down right now, because it is very counterintuitive for him to to say the same thing if you're saying, well, how's he going to get other people involved? I think there's other people out there who are quiet who may jump on the bandwagon as we head toward the 8th of November.
Okay. Let's move on. The U.S. State Department has confirmed that an American freelance journalist has been held by Turkish authorities since the beginning of August. Lindsay Snell was detained after crossing the border from Syria into Turkey and has now been charged with violating a military zone. Jane, this throws up a number of issues, not least U.S.-Turkey relations and also press freedom inside Turkey. What's the big issue that stands out for you on this story?
Well, Turkey, as you say, has a massive press freedom problem. It's not unusual for it to jail journalists. It jails more of them than most countries in the world. But it is interesting, some of the statements that have come out of Turkey at this time, including the prosecutor saying it's not clear whether the journalist was a spy. Obviously, if it's not clear, why is it being mentioned? It comes at a time when a lot of quite conspiratorial rhetoric is coming out of the government, suggesting that the US was even complicit in the recent failed coup attempt in Turkey. And you've seen a real parting of ways between Russia, between Turkey and the US over the Kurds, always a point of friction, but something that really does seem to change and something which Russia and Iran are very keen to exploit.
Tom, on the issue of US-Turkish relations, Joe Biden was recently sent there to sort of try to placate President Erdogan.
He bent over backwards on that trip. He actually, yeah.
Despite the fact that he was met by the deputy mayor of Ankara to greet him off the plane, which is, I mean, if Joe Biden turned up here, I can't imagine us sending the deputy mayor of London to greet him there.
That's what the Mexican president should have done with Trump.
that would have been interesting. Tom, it's tricky, isn't it, for the US? Because, look, let's not forget, Turkey is a NATO ally, has been a member of NATO since 1952, has the second largest army inside NATO, and also, yes, it has played a dubious game with Syria, whether that has been essentially helping to create ISIS in its own backwards way. But it is also a nation that has a 500 plus mile long border with Syria. It's a lot easier for people sitting in Brussels or London or DC to say, well, this is how you should treat Syria, because we don't share that border with them. But that relationship between the US and Turkey has been fraught over the last few years, hasn't it?
Certainly spiky. And you're absolutely right. And it is very, very complex. You can't boil it down into black and white. If you put it down in this latest, if you will, situation, if you say, look, hands off the Kurdish Syrian militia, because they're the best ground forces that the U.S. is backing right now. And Erdogan saying, no, we think they're part of the PKK and we're going to go after them as well as ISIS. And not a whole lot of influence Washington has right now. They're sitting back and watching this thing unfold before their very eyes, saying, what should we do? And you see Erdogan kind of cozying up then to the Russians, saying, well, if you want to play ball with me, I'll play ball with Moscow. I think the administration is really flat-footed on what the heck they're going to be doing with Turkey down the road. They're short on answers at this stage of the game.
Is the big problem, Jane, that the West wants Turkey to agree with them that the big threat is ISIS, and Turkey's turning around saying, well, we accept there are threats, but we feel the biggest threat is the Kurds?
The big problem is that there are so many bad options in Syria, and almost no country has had a consistent position about which the worst evil has been. So until very recently, Turkey's view was still that Assad was the main problem, the Kurds were a secondary problem, and ISIS probably a tertiary problem. Now they've become so preoccupied by the Kurds because of the surge in PKK attacks at home that has become number one. But it doesn't have to be that way. The Kurds in Syria itself have been content with a fairly limited form of autonomy. It's not even formal federalism. They're not Kurdish separatists seeking a greater Kurdish state. Turkey could have a more sophisticated way of dealing with them.
And actually did. Not so long ago, there were peace talks that Erdogan was leading.
Yes, he was speaking to the PKK. He also oversaw a remarkable rapprochement with the Kurds in Iraq, which is still there. You know, the Turks are the greatest foreign ally of the Kurdistan regional government
so
in Iraq.
So why has that changed, do you think?
Perhaps because there's been so many perceived threats coming at Erdogan from different directions, that where early on he was making the moves of a confident leader who felt he had a secure base, a big lower middle class and working class that had got rich under him that would support him, he could afford to take some sophisticated and daring steps, including outreach to the Kurds. Now he sees enemies everywhere.
And Tom, if you were advising John Kerry, what would you be telling him to do in relation to the US partnership or relationship with Turkey? Because, as you say, they sent Joe Biden, as you described it, bent over backwards. But, you know, there is an argument that, well, the US needs to do what it can to get Turkey on side. It can't afford to say, oh, well, look, you know, we disagree with you on this, so we're not talking to you about that.
I think you're going to need a stronger line out of Washington to say, you know, you really do need us more than you think right now. And you really need us to help you work through this in the coming months. And I really don't hear that right now. We've got, in essence, a lame duck president right now.
But sorry, how can we? Like, you say there should be a strong line, but then what happens if Turkey turns around and says, "Well, look, you know, we want you to hand over Fethullah Gulen, and we're going to do what we want in the region."
It's muddy, and Turkey has some good cards to play. And that's what I said at the beginning of this, that the U.S. is kind of scratching their heads at this stage of the game on what really they can do. But in some way, you're going to have to show more resolve, more backbone than certainly the vice president did on that recent trip.
But sorry, on that issue of more backbone, I don't understand what that leads to.
I think you say, however you say it, however financial support, whatever you can do to support Erdogan right now, you have to say, look, there's going to be some carrots down the road, and right now what you have to do is play ball our way, lay off the Kurds, at least in the short term, till we can sort out what's going to happen eventually with Aleppo, and then you can carry on and see where we are at that stage. But I don't hear that kind of language right now from the administration.
Jane, do you think that sort of tactic would work with Turkey right now?
Something needs to be tried. Because the US and Turkey do need each other, especially in this fight against ISIS. And you've seen the massive airport attack in Turkey recently, a string of other attacks by ISIS. They do have a common interest there that could be worked on. But it will take a lot of hard diplomatic work, which an outgoing administration or an incoming administration probably aren't going to be doing.
Okay, we'll leave it there just for now. You're listening to Midori House, here with me, Steve Bloomfield, and my guests, Jane Kinnamont and Tom Rivers. Coming up...
It's maddening, it's disappointing. When you're accused of doing something that is so foreign to your values, it brings out an outrage in you. Apple has always been about doing the right thing. We haven't done anything wrong, and the Irish government hasn't done anything wrong.
The boss of Apple says that the tech giant's retrospective tax bill is unjust. Does he have a point? We'll discuss that in just a moment.
Being a pop star seems like a dazzling, lavish lifestyle, right? But have you ever wondered how your favourite pop song was written?
I do a lot of writing in the bath with my housemates sat on the toilet taking a photo.
Or who that song was really intended for.
Writing love songs in Spanish, I could say really pathetic, sad things, and it would be a secret from the audience and also from the person that I was writing about.
Join us on The Sessions at Midori House each week, where we bring in a wealth of musical talent to perform live for us and reveal a few truths about making music and keeping your ego under control. Well, sometimes.
I'm unconsciously comparing myself like a jackass to Paul McCartney.
From electropop to indie rock and with plenty of soul to boot, tune into The Sessions at Midori House every Saturday at 8:15 London time for lessons in stardom and a soundtrack to kickstart your weekend.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in the studio, Tom Rivers and Jane Kinnamont. Apple's chief executive, Tim Cook, says the European Commission ruling that his company should pay billions of euros in backdated tax to Ireland is maddening and political. He told the Irish broadcaster RTE that Apple had not been given preferential tax breaks in the country. Tom Rivers, Tim Cook is furious there that his company is being told to pay more tax than the roughly 1% he had been paying. Does he have a point?
Well, I tell you, I mean, if I think he should, you know, stump up some money. Ireland needs the money. But if the Irish government said, look, come and base your European or your international headquarters here, we'll cut a sweet deal. And it's by definition legal to do so. You can understand why multinationals might take up that option. If they're going to say, I'm going to pay less taxes here than I am across the globe, then maybe that's a good idea. But boy, I tell you, it's maddening, because the fact when you have a hole of 14.5 billion, let's put it in dollars, you need that money for infrastructure, for road building, for bridges, for fill in the blank. Who ends up paying that hole? It's the average Joe out there who kind of is looking at this saying, if I have to pay my taxes, I expect the others to pay a fair shake as well. And that certainly appears not to be the case in Ireland.
Jane, there's a number of things that are odd about this whole thing. But the thing I find curious is that this tax, this 13 billion euros, should therefore go to Ireland. Because Ireland has struck this deal to encourage Apple to come and bring its jobs and its prestige to Ireland. And that's why it's offered such an almost ludicrously low tax rate. Those jobs have gone to Ireland at the expense of other nations, including the 27 other members of the European Union, arguably. So surely Ireland shouldn't be able to take the jobs and the prestige and now say, oh, great, and we'll take the tax as well. Shouldn't they go to the other European Union members?
Well, Ireland probably will find itself suffering as a result of this, because big companies like paying low amounts of tax, that's true. But big companies also massively value predictability. And many of them would choose a developed country with strong institutions where they know what sort of tax they're going to be paying for the next 10 years over an emerging market jurisdiction where there's very little tax, but you don't know what the government's going to do tomorrow. So this is something that could be seen as hurting Ireland's investment reputation in the future. And it's also going to mean a lot of lucrative work for lawyers as companies hastily scramble to check that the deals they're making in particular European countries are compatible with a vast body of European legislation.
There's a broader problem here, Tom, isn't there? That as companies become more and more multinational, that governments increasingly have to work together to ensure that there aren't loopholes that big multinationals with lots of money can wriggle through. So we've had instances of where Starbucks have managed to say, oh, no, actually, all our profits are in another country. Despite, oh, I know you paid for your coffee here in London, but actually, yeah, the proprietary information behind making that coffee is based in Luxembourg. So we're paying our tax there. Or there's been other companies, which we won't necessarily name here, that have loaned all their profits from one country to the companies based in another country where the tax there is going to be minuscule. This is at least an example where the European Commission is saying, look, matey, you may try and pull that trick here in Europe, but we're not going to let you do that anymore.
It may set a precedent, Steve, in that this is the way that, you know, from this point on, this is how all you multinationals will be dealt with throughout the 27 maybe now nations of the EU.
Still 28. We haven't signed off.
Well, eventually 28. But you're absolutely right. And it has to start somewhere. And it has to be very painful. And the best lawyers on the planet are going to be coming in the busload to the defense of Apple in this case. And who's to know if they're going to win this case or not? But at least puts a marker down there saying, in the future, no. If you're making all kinds of money in country X, Y, or Z, guess what? You have to pay a little bit at each of those countries. And that is sometimes, as you point out, not the case right now. And a lot of people on the street are saying that's not fair. That is not above board. Something has to change. And it has to do with the tax codes, which are, you know, volumes high in every country. And they're filled and filled and filled with loopholes that help the big guy and doesn't help at all the little guy.
Okay, we'll move on. British Airways has resumed direct flights to Iran after a 4-year suspension. It follows the lifting of sanctions on the country. Daily flights will begin later this year. Back in April, Air France began flights again from Tehran to Paris and vice versa. Jane Kinnamont, will you be hopping on a flight to Tehran now that you can? Or can you actually?
There are still a lot of political tensions between the UK and Iran, which date back to the colonial era. And you're going to see a lot of British Iranians and a lot of British business people getting on these flights because previously they had to go via Germany or Austria or so forth. But still, for British journalists or people like me who are researchers, it remains quite difficult to actually get visas to access Iran. So far, I've never been able to go. I think there are a number of tourism companies hoping that people will go to Iran as an exciting new destination. You can even go skiing. There's great history, all sorts of things to see. But there's been a bit of a blow to that as well, because the US has brought in these new visa regulations, which mean that if you have been to Iran in the last 5 years, you have to apply in advance for a visa to the US, which British people normally don't have to get. So it's been a rocky road to normalisation.
Yeah, you're right. Exactly. In fact, that happened to a colleague of mine. Exactly that point. It is going to be easier, I guess, in this opening up process. But as we say, Steve, it doesn't mean the door's wide open. It's going to be complications. There's going to be half step, half measures as well. And the flip side of the coin is you're looking at a lot of companies. BA wants to do business. Boeing wants to do business. Airbus wants to do business. It is a market that is crying out to do business. It's demographically pretty young, and there are deals to be struck. And the momentum for that is going to be, I think, in my view, unstoppable as we carry on in the coming years here.
Jane, you mentioned tensions between Britain and Iran that go back to colonial times. I've always quite enjoyed the fact that the embassy in Tehran, the British embassy in Tehran, the road that it's on was renamed about 20 or so years ago to Bobby Sands Road, named after the Irish Republican hunger striker. Those things aren't going to change overnight, are they?
To some extent, people try to accommodate them. If you get a business card from one of the small number of British diplomats that are working in Tehran, they just use the street round the corner for Duce Street, which means Paradise Street, so much nicer.
Excellent.
That mistrust is there. At the same time, there is an element of mutual respect. In fact, Iran probably overestimates the importance of Britain in the world because it thinks it's such a perfidious force that it's more important than the US. And to some extent, Brits are flattered by that. At the same time, I think there's wide recognition among UK policymakers and business people that Iran is a pivotal country in the Middle East, one of the largest countries, quite a complex and diversified economy, very educated and so forth. But there's going to be a lot of uncertainty through till the middle of next year at least, because we will be facing further presidential elections in Iran, talk of Ahmadinejad possibly running again, and no certainty at all that Rouhani will keep his post.
Just on that note, it's worth going to, I think it's issue 6 of Monocle, so almost 10 years ago now, we did a very nice piece on the flight between that opened up between Tehran and Caracas. After Ahmadinejad and Hugo Chavez became friends, our very own Andrew Muller wrote that piece. Well worth looking up. This flight between London and Tehran is likely to be far more lucrative for Iran than any flight to Caracas, isn't it?
I would think so. And again, they're starting with a half dozen returns per week. They want it to be, I guess, a scheduled daily flight. Not too far in the distant future. And I think that I think there's the traffic there. I think they're going to have probably full flights, you know, every single day with this thing gets rolling.
Okay, we'll see how it goes. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks to Tom Rivers and Jane Kinnamont. The programme was produced by Rhys James. It was researched by Fernanda Augusta Pacheco and Molly Ingleby. The studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. We've got The Urbanist coming up in about half an hour's time. Andrew Tuck, your host as ever. And then The Monocle Daily at 2200. Do stay tuned throughout the evening. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.